First case this morning is Scoggins versus the People, case number 10, SC 15. Are both parties present and ready to proceed? Justice Marquez will not participate in this case. That's why she's not here. So let's hear from the appellant, please. Let me mention a couple of quick housekeeping rules. One is you have to keep track of your own time. It's 15 minutes per side, and please state your name and whom you represent at the beginning of your argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Bender. My name is Ellen Eggleston, registration number 14598, public defender. I'm here this morning on behalf of petitioner Richard Scoggins. The issue we're discussing today is whether the Court of Appeals erroneously construed the cost statute, which is 18.1.3701, to provide that the prosecution may seek an order for costs after sentencing. And as relief, Mr. Scoggins is requesting this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision as erroneous and to vacate the post-sentencing order assessing costs of extradition against him. But this morning, with the court's permission, I'd like to jump into and address a few issues that the Attorney General raised in her reply brief and that I think merit some further discussion. I'd like to begin by addressing the state's first argument, which suggests that a statutory provision entitled Alternatives in Sentencing or Alternatives in Imposition of Sentence 18.1.3104F provides that the assessment of costs are actually part of a criminal sentence, and that therefore upon resentencing, when a criminal defendant revokes probation, as Mr. Scoggins did, that the trial court is able to impose any sentence it could have originally imposed. I'd like to talk about that language because at first blush, I think the state's contention looks like it has arguable merit, but I don't think that 18.1.3104 transforms costs into a sentence, and here's why. Petitioner contends that costs and sentence, as well as other pieces of the pie, constitute a judgment of conviction. The assessment of costs is not a sentence. It's not part of the sentence. The sentence is the punitive part of the judgment of conviction that the court is entitled to impose.
Doesn't the minimus, though, consist of all of that? I mean, and the minimus is actually the controlling document.
Yes, Justice Rice, and I think that the court in Fisher got to the heart of this because the court in Fisher basically said that it spoke to the order setting the sentence that directed the defendant to pay costs. And I think the order setting the sentence is the minimus. And what I think that this language suggests is that the statutory language, it says, the trial court has the following alternatives in entering judgment imposing sentence, recognizes that the sentence is part of the entry of judgment. It's merely basically saying, it's indicating these are the options that the legislature's permitting the court to consider and impose when entering judgment of conviction. I don't think that it says at all that this is a sentence. Now, you know, I will admit that the language in subsection F, which designates the defendant may be sentenced to payment of costs, that's problematic, but I don't think that those are magic words that transform the payment of costs into a sentence, for the reason that the cost statute itself expressly treats costs as a judgment, and a judgment that should be assessed, a judgment that needs to be, I'm forgetting, enforceable in the same manner as a civil judgment, but it's not a sentence. I think that we have, what we have here is basically language that the General Assembly has promulgated that recognizes that a sentence is part of a judgment of conviction, and when imposing sentence as part of the judgment of conviction, the court has the ability to enter an assessment of costs pursuant to the cost statute. As
opposed I mean, I thought all that meant was that once you entered a judgment of conviction and you included the costs within it, if the defendant didn't pay the costs, you could pursue him civilly for payment of the costs. One could pursue him civilly for payment of costs without having to obtain another judgment, a civil judgment, if you will, that minimus or order of judgment
again
suffices.
I think that the notion that the costs assessment is an independent civil liability is not correct either. I think that it certainly is a sanction that the court can impose that is enforceable as though it were a civil liability, but the cost statute doesn't say it's a civil liability, and the General Assembly certainly could have said that if it wanted to, but it didn't, and what kind of a creature it is, all we know is that it's a sanction that will be collected as though it were a civil liability. But I think that there's an important distinction to be drawn, because the court in Tipton clearly recognized and delineated that an assessment of costs has many more ramifications than a mere civil judgment or a civil liability. The court in Tipton recognized that even though such an assessment can be collected civilly, that it also attaches sometimes as a condition to a sentence or to probation, and that it has grave ramifications or implications for a criminal defendant if it is not satisfied. So certainly Tipton recognized that the way to collect the cost assessment is through civil means, but that it certainly has many more grave ramifications than a strict lien or civil obligation.
Siegelson, by this question, I don't mean to disrespect or disregard the language of the applicable statutes. However, moving outside of that for just a moment, I guess my question is, what are the negative ramifications, if any, to an interpretation of the court of costs as part of the sentence? Are there implications of that that would be problematic for some reason?
Well, the one that I can think of right off the top of my head, Justice Martinez, is that if the court were to construe it as punishment, then of course there would be double jeopardy implications arising when the assessment of costs occurred after sentencing. Now, the Howell case addressed that very issue and decided that
Before you go on with that, would calling costs part of the sentence necessarily imply that it was a punitive sanction and call into question the jeopardy issues that you're about to discuss?
I'm sorry, could you?
Well, you're about to discuss jeopardy issues, and you're basically saying if it's punitive, then there are jeopardy consequences.
Right.
And my question is, do we get to punitive if the court interprets the statute as making costs part of the sentence? Does that necessarily imply that it's a punitive part of the sentence?
I think it does. I think that the approach the Howell court took is that it's meant to reimburse, it's not meant to punish, The assessment of costs is imposed for purposes of making whole.
Why would that change simply because it's part of the sentence?
Well, the punitive, you mean aside from the double jeopardy?
I mean, you say if you call it part of the sentence, then it's punitive, and then it's not imposed for these other reasons. And my question is, can't it be part of the sentence and still not be punitive and still imposed for other reasons?
Well, case law appears to take the tack that a sentence is punitive. That is the punitive part of the judgment of conviction, and that these other components in the judgment of conviction are not, they're not necessary, they're imposed for a reason, but not necessarily for punishment purposes. And, you know, Howell goes into great explication about that. So I think that it's not just a matter of semantics. I think that it's important that an assessment of costs not be labeled as punishment or as punitive. And I think that, you know, once you cross that bridge, in my client's case, there may not be necessarily, I mean, I'm certainly not conceding this, but it's possible there's not a double jeopardy implication, because if you were to go that route and say that it was punishment and therefore that the trial court was able to impose that cost as a part of the sentence it originally could have, you may not have the double jeopardy issue in that particular instance, but you certainly would have that double jeopardy issue arise if you just had a straight situation where sentence was imposed and then because the prosecution forgot or whatnot, asked for an assessment later, that would certainly raise the double jeopardy implication and unnecessarily, I think.
Can I ask another variation on the, or a question that comes to mind that has to do with whether we treat costs as the sentence, as part of the sentence? The Attorney General made the argument, I believe, in the answer brief that because in this particular case, the cost at issue was imposed at a resentencing in conjunction with or as part of the revocation of probation, that therefore it's expressly allowed by the language that says the defendant can be sentenced to anything he could have been sentenced to in the first place. Is the argument against that, from your point of view, solely dependent on finding that costs are not part of the sentence? And I guess another way of saying that is, if we were to find that costs could be considered part of the sentence, would that argument have merit? Would then, without regard to the general question of any reasonable time that the Court of Appeals said, would it at least follow that costs could be imposed in a resentencing following or as part of probation revocation?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And if I'm understanding your question correctly, the reason I respond that way is because final judgment enters. I understand that if you can resentence upon a probation revocation, that's a different kettle of fish. But under normal circumstances, you don't have the ability to say, well, we didn't impose costs here, and therefore we get to jump outside of the sentencing and judgment of conviction timeline in order to backtrack and assess them, because judgment of conviction will already have entered.
The defendant can be resentenced in the case of probation revocation, can he not?
Yes.
To anything he could have been sentenced to originally.
As long as you conclude that the sentence is punitive. Or is the assessment of costs is a punitive part of the sentence.
Well, am I understanding then that you're saying if we treated costs as part of the sentence, then it would be okay to impose costs at a revocation probation?
No, I'm not saying that I think it would be okay, but I think that since the plain language of the cost statute clearly doesn't treat costs as a punitive part of the sentence, it treats it as an assessment.
So I think I'm understanding you to say the reason that you can't impose costs at a probation revocation proceeding is because costs are not part of the sentence. Is that right?
That's correct. It's part of the judgment of conviction.
Okay.
Thank you for leading that horse to water. I see that I have only seconds left, and I think what I'd like to end with is that the state contended that there's a conflict, or contends that there's a conflict between the statute and the court's procedural rule, and therefore the court's rule must yield. And I just want to jump in and say that I don't perceive that conflict, that the constraint and controlling Colorado law, including Hellman v. Roe, recognizes that a judgment of conviction is composed of several procedural steps, and the state wrongly suggests that the rule steps on the toes of the statute when including costs of judgment or as a component of the judgment of conviction. I see my time's up. Thank you very much.
Ms. Engel?
May it please the court. My name is Clemmy Engel. I'm from the Colorado Attorney General's office, and I'm representing the people in this appeal. Our issue on cert is the permissible timing of a Section 701 order for costs of prosecution. But as the foundation for addressing that, I think we need to be clear on the nature of the order for costs of prosecution in this case. And I hope in my brief I have not led the defense or the court astray. I am not suggesting that the court in this case imposed costs as part of the criminal sentence under Section 104. Either my brief is unclear or else the defense misunderstood my argument on that point. So let me comment briefly on that first. In my brief, I mentioned that I thought there was arguable tension in the several statutes concerning costs. On the one hand, we have the language of the cost of prosecution statute, 18.1.3701, and the case law decided under it, which say that the costs of prosecution are an independent civil liability distinct from and separate from the criminal sentence. Rule 32 also recognizes that the cost and the sentence are two separate items. And I believe the parties are in agreement on that point, and that was the basis for the order of cost that was imposed in this case. In my brief, in an effort to take account of the entire statutory scheme, really on my own motion, and as a digression, I'm afraid, I asked, what about Section 104, which says that the court may sentence the defendant to payment of costs? Is that a potential fly in the ointment? The best I can do in order to give effect to both of those statutes is to suggest that, as I did in my brief, that the legislature created dual bases of authority for imposition of costs. And for that suggestion, I seized on the analytical model that the Scott case gives us, which I discussed in my brief. But in this case, at least, I think it's clear that Section 104 does not come into play. I think it's clear that here we're dealing with an order for costs imposed under Section 701 independently of the criminal sentence. And the question is whether that kind of 701 order for costs has to be imposed at the same time as sentencing. So on the issue of the permissible timing of a Section 701 order for costs, the first question is whether the statute, Section 701, contains any express time limitation. And the answer is no. The Court of Appeals, I think, quite correctly refused to find a time limitation in the phrase where any person is.
And an example of that would be an extradition circumstance when you skip the jurisdiction, when you miss, reporting your parole officer or probation, go to another state, you have to be extradited.
That's an example of a person.
Right, and that doesn't fit in with this judgment of conviction notice. Because, the court has to have power to be able to do that later on, right?
Well, right, yeah, the question we're all going to get to, if this is not part of the if the order for cause is not part of the criminal sentence.
Right.
Does it have to be part of the judgment of conviction?
I guess what I'm asking you is.
Saying, does it have to be?
Right. Can it be done anytime the case still resides in the trial court, is what I'm asking you.
Yes, I think it can be delayed.
Yeah.
And because I think, you know, without any express time limitation enacted in the statute, then the second question becomes, now, given the absence of that express time limit, what was the legislative intent concerning permissible timing? And as the Court of Appeals observed, if the legislature had wanted to impose a time limit, it could have, and it didn't. Therefore, the conclusion is the legislature intended there was no time limit.
Do we normally think that follows, or if the legislature didn't impose a time limit for anything, would we find that a rule imposing a time limit would not be in conflict with the statute?
Well, that's really what I'm getting to next, which is, I think, the crux or the heart of the defendant's argument as made in their briefs in this court, at least, not in the Court of Appeals. But let me comment, you know, if, for example, we have, I believe it's section 18.14.010, providing for a post-conviction remedy. And for many years, that provided no time limit. When the legislature saw fit, they enacted 16.5.402 and slapped a time limit on it. So they could do that within a judgment for cause, but they haven't. I think the real question, though, as raised by the defense that we need to address is, didn't the legislature, by its silence, intend to defer to this court's rulemaking power as to the timing of an order for costs? And doesn't Rule 32 require that costs be assessed at the time the judgment of conviction is entered? And I would submit that, again, the answer is no, because the Sanoff case tells us that it's the province of the legislature and not of the court's rulemaking power to specify which items are a required component of a judgment of conviction. And the legislature has not specified or even hinted in section 701 that the cost must be a component of the judgment of conviction.
May I follow up on that just a minute? So do you read Sanoff to say that if the legislature fails to provide a time limitation, the court cannot do so for something?
I don't think it necessarily says that, but I...
Because Sanoff really was a case in which the legislature then came and imposed a specific time limit. Is that not right?
Correct. But, you know, my argument is the court would, in this situation, would exceed its rulemaking power if it provided in Rule 32 that costs must be a component of the judgment of conviction. And that's why I maintain that to construe Rule 32 harmoniously with the statute, that Rule 32's phrase, quote, costs if any are assessed, end quote, has to be construed to mean any costs that may have been imposed or any costs that actually were assessed at the time of sentencing.
And it is? No.
It can't be construed to require that any costs must be assessed at the time of sentencing and never thereafter.
If the legislature, let's go to this in a broad sense. I mean, that seems to me a pretty broad rule. If I understand what you're suggesting is that despite the fact that the legislature has not imposed a time limit with regard to some requirement, and therefore a judicially imposed time limit would not be in conflict directly with that, are you still saying, what, as a matter of separation of powers, or what? Why would the judiciary not be able to impose a rule which arguably could be seen as management of the day-to-day operations of the court? Where do we draw that line?
Well, as I argue in the brief, under the separation of powers doctrine, obviously my argument needs to be that this is a substantive policy decision by the legislature to require no time limit as to costs. And it does stand on a different footing than any other, than the sentence or any other component of the judgment of conviction, in that there are no criminal consequences that attach to a failure to pay the cost. No liberty interests are affected. I think, as one of the cases says, the only consequence is that the defendant's non-exempt property can be executed on the same as the civil judgment.
That cut in the direction of it being substantive or in the direction of it being more the operation of the courts? In terms of payment of costs.
It's obviously it can be argued either way. I think Wiedemer tells us that obviously that was addressed in 16.5402, but it does tell us that matters concerning a statute of limitation are substantive where substantive policy considerations underlie them. Conversely, I would argue by extension of that that an absence of the legislative absence of a provision for statute of limitations can be construed as a legislative policy decision that they want this to be able to be imposed without time limitation as to when it needs to be imposed.
While I'm interrupting your argument completely anyway, let me go back to one thing you said earlier. And I'm not sure the importance you attach to this, especially since you sort of introduced your argument here as showing tension between various statutes. But you again, in your argument here, repeated that 1.3701, and I believe you said, refers to an assessment of costs as a civil judgment. And actually, it does that sort of by simile, right? And it says this can be enforced like a civil judgment, in the manner of a civil judgment, whatever the language it specifically uses. And the question, I sort of had a double question here. One is, what significance do you attach to that? And apparently some. But the other is, doesn't that same provision refer to a fine just as costs as being able to be enforced like a civil judgment? And surely a fine is considered part of this criminal sentence, isn't it?
Yes, a fine is definitely part of the criminal sentence. To answer your second question first, the difference is that Section 701 has a sentence in there which expressly says that a fine can be imposed only as provided in Section 104, which I take to mean that a fine can be imposed only as part of the sentence under Section 104. Section 701 does not contain an equivalent sentence as to costs. Now, to answer your first question about the statutory language, it's true that Section 701 only says something like the judgment for costs shall be enforceable in the same manner as a civil judgment. So you could, from that language, conclude or construe that, I suppose, as saying, well, this is a criminal-type sanction enforceable the same as a civil judgment. But the problem with that is the case law construing the statute, most notably Howell, I think very clearly says this is an independent civil liability. And I believe the Scott case, even though it talks about orders for reimbursement for court-appointed counsel, also makes the same point. So I think if you wanted to hold that this, if an order for costs imposed under 701 is not a distinct and separate civil sanction, distinct and separate from the criminal sentence, you would really have to confront Howell and probably disapprove of any language in Howell that's inconsistent with that construction. The defendant in the defense in their brief, I found it interesting, said that the legislature did not express an intent to, quote, decommission costs, end quote, from their role as a component of the judgment of conviction as required in Rule 32. And I suppose you could say the Sadoff case recognized that the legislature decommissioned the amount of restitution from having to be included in the initial judgment of conviction. But that's putting the cart before the horse, because restitution has always been considered part of the criminal sentence. We don't start with the rule, we start with the statute. I think that our statute, Section 701, has bloodlines going back to the 19th century, which I think was well before Rule 32 ever existed. And I suppose you could even say that when the legislature amended Section 701 in minor respects in years like 2008. It presumably was aware of the 1975 Fisher case and the 2002 Howell case, both saying that although it was the better practice, it was not mandatory to order court costs at the date of sentencing.
It seems to me that that kind of interpretation is suggested, especially because the word prosecution seems to be a broad phrase in this statute. There are lots of elements of prosecution when the officer of the state assigned to follow all these steps that may happen after a judgment of conviction that seem to be indicated here. There's lots of, you know, travel, deposition, preparation of evidence, other kinds of costs here, that the plain intent goes beyond just the entry of judgment of conviction. What is your response to that? That prosecution means anything that happens in the trial court that invokes the officer that's in charge of prosecuting the case, and that prosecution wasn't meant just the trial that ends in the judgment of conviction.
If I understand the question correctly, my best answer would be to refer you to the Howell case, which discusses the remedial nature of an order for costs as being remedial as opposed to being punitive. I'm just about out of time, so finally let me close with the my threshold argument, which was in argument one of my brief, that even if an order for costs does have to be imposed at the time of sentencing, that's really what we had in this case, because a sentence imposed in revocation upon revocation of probation does become part of a new final appealable judgment of conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Ng.
Thank you.
Thank half the court. I'd like to thank both of you for your briefs and your arguments. The case will stand submitted.